Okay, hi everybody. We'll get this going. I think people may come and go as they do at conferences, but welcome. Thanks so much for coming to this session. I'm Jenny Weeks. I am the Environment and Energy Editor at The Conversation based in Boston, and I'm really psyched about this panel. I appreciate so much all of the speakers coming here for this. It's a pretty simple goal here. We want to, you know, identify cool stories about the environment and cities. I mean, this is a city conference, so, you know, that's, you know, what I wanted to do was let's get lots of topics out there. But let's also talk about angles that may be different from what you've done in previous reporting to think about urban issues. And I'm thinking of things like zoning and finance and empowerment. And, you know, these are, I'm not saying these aren't things that environmental journalists explore, but we tend to think about things like emissions levels and permitting and stuff like that. So, you know, I just am really happy to have speakers who can talk about what's going on with people living in cities from such different angles. And also how to work with and report on communities that may not be represented in the mainstream media and to do it in a smart and respectful way. So I definitely want to, you know, hear any suggestions that all of you have about that since it's what you do. I'm going to run through everybody's bios really quickly here, and then just each of the speakers will talk for about 10 minutes, and then we'll get discussion going. So Oscar Periabello, to my immediate right here, is editor of Next City, and their websites are up here. So please check out their sites if you haven't, because they're really cool. Next City provides daily online coverage of the leaders, policies, and innovations driving progress in metro regions across the world. Before he became the editor of Next City in 2018, Oscar was a contributing writer there. And since 2011, he has covered community development finance, community banking, impact investing, equitable and inclusive economies, affordable housing, fair housing, and more for media outlets such as ShelterForce, B Magazine, Impact Alpha, and Fast Company. Serena Maria Daniels, next down, is a contributing writer for Next City, where she covers income inequality and its effects on communities of color in and out of Detroit. Serena is also co-founder and editor of Tostada, an online magazine founded on the premise that food is the unifying theme that breaks down barriers and preserves culture. Tostada celebrates the many communities that contribute to Metro Detroit's food world, so if you want to know where to eat before you're leaving, here is your source. She has also had a lot of interesting past positions, including dining editor for the Detroit Metro Times and staff writer for the Chicago Tribune, and her reporting has appeared in a lot of outlets, including Lucky Peach, Eater, Reuters, and the Detroit News. And then Rick Sadler is an assistant professor of public health at Michigan State University based here at their campus in Flint, and he is a Flint native. An urban geographer with expertise in environmental science, GIS, food systems planning, and land use policy in legacy cities. And his research interests include integrating urban planning and public health topics related to neighborhood and built environmental effects on health. The overarching goal of his work is to strengthen the understanding between the built environment and health behaviors and outcomes with the objective of shaping land use policy to build healthier cities. So I think we have a lot of stuff to hear about and talk about. And I'm just going to ask each of the speakers going down the line like that to talk for maybe 10 minutes about what you see as big stories in cities right now, things that are being well covered, things that are not being so well covered, and ideas for people who want to dig into them and learn about them. Okay. So go ahead. And if we get past 10 minutes for each of you, I'll just kind of wave.
All right.
I'm not going to do any little timer things or any games like that.
Great. I'm actually gonna try to do it to myself, so I keep on track. So, thanks Jennifer for inviting us to speak here, and hello everyone. Good morning. I'm Oscar Periabello, the editor of Next City. Just saying that for the record because they're recording this session, and they need to know what my voice yet sounds like. Mm-hmm. All right. So I'm Oscar, and as editor of Next City, just a little bit more about what we do. We publish about 7 to 10 stories, originally reported stories a week. One of those is usually a 3,000 to 4,000 kind of long-form story, deeply reported. It can take anywhere from days to months to report on that story. And we'll do one of those a week, and then the others will be about 800 to maybe 1,200, 1,500 word reported stories. Maybe you'll be on the phone with two to three sources for one of those stories. And we work primarily with freelancers on those, so Serena being one of our contributing writers that we worked with over the years. Our writers are generally stationed in the cities that they're covering. We have a few contributors who are specialists maybe in housing or zoning, or I was a contributor that specialized in finance, so I was writing about, you know, how do you get capital for housing, for small business, for economic revitalization, or for environmental remediation of some kind. I would cover that in different cities as a kind of finance reporter. And like I said, 7 to 10 stories a week. So please pitch us, especially in this area. We're looking for more coverage of things like stormwater management, water systems. How are they getting cleaned up? Who is putting solar panels, and where are they putting solar panels? And I'll talk through some of these in a minute, because I'm gonna talk through four questions that kind of help me decide whether or not I want to assign that story, or whether or not I want to accept that pitch for a story. So there's also bike share, anything around transportation, I think can be an environmental kind of story, because we're talking about mostly how do we get people out of cars and into something that's cleaner and more sustainable and more environmentally friendly, also safer. So there's four questions that I wanted to really throw out there to help you kind of understand how to report on cities. And these are four questions that are important to me, but I feel like they're also important to any kind of metro editor or any publication really that, or editor that is focused on a city or many cities. You know, we're not the only publication that is focused on cities. I should say we're a nonprofit independent media publication as well, so we're online only, and we're grant funded, and we're funded by members from our readers. So the four questions. The first question that's important to me is, who benefits from whatever this thing is? So let's think of one like bike share. So, you know, these are programs where usually there's like some kind of fancy bike rack where you've seen them probably. You got to pay a little bit. You got to rent the bike. So when I think about who benefits, I think about, all right, bike share is coming to a city. Where is it coming? Is it coming only to the downtown kind of touristy areas? Is it coming only to the wealthy kind of gentrifying areas where there's lots of new condos and new luxury apartment buildings coming in? Or is it also going out to lower income neighborhoods? Neighborhoods where, let's say, all the workers from the hotels downtown live. Is it also there? And are they using it? So that's a question of, like, who benefits? Who benefits also includes who's going to work on something. Let's say a city is putting $1 billion into cleaning up its water system and updating all these old pipes, especially on the East Coast. We're talking like, you know, 300-400-year-old cities, lots of pipes to fix. Who's going to get those jobs? Is it going to be union jobs? And if it's union jobs, are the unions representative of the workers in those neighborhoods, or do the unions represent primarily suburban workers who are going to be coming into these places and doing all these projects and getting all these good paying jobs, but they don't live in these cities? Whereas if the city itself especially is going to be issuing bonds and paying taxpayer money to clean up its water system, are the residents of that city going to benefit from the jobs created in cleaning up the water systems? So that's another dimension of who benefits. And I have 10 minutes, so I'm going to move on to another question. Then the next question is, whose idea was this? So if you start reporting on cities, you may start to get a lot of press releases from mayors, council members, all kinds of nonprofit organizations, or even national organizations. You might start to get press releases from car share companies or bike share companies. Whenever there's a solution or some kind of problem or policy or program proposed, where is that idea coming from? Is it coming from, let's say, a community-based organization that's been fighting for clean water for decades? Is it coming from a community-based organization that represents tenants in a low-income neighborhood that's trying to reduce the electricity bills for the residents of that low-income neighborhood? So they want to build solar panels on the tops of all the apartment buildings, or maybe the homes on tops of those buildings, so the residents in that neighborhood can lower their electric bills. If it's coming from a mayor, if the mayor is sending out a proposal, guaranteed, 99 times out of 100, it's not the mayor's idea. Someone else brought it to the mayor's attention. Someone on the ground asked for it. Perhaps someone from a venture capital firm 1,000 miles away paid for it. So whose idea is this? Where is it coming from? And who really deserves credit? Because I think that's also part of our responsibility as journalists, is really, especially if it's a historically marginalized community, if it's a grassroots community, if it's a low-income community that's been asking for something for decades, we want to make sure that those voices get credit for it. And you can treat them as experts just like you treat any other scientist or policymaker. And we're talking about organizations that have been around, tenant-based organizations, community-based organizations that have been around for decades. It wasn't news to them when Flint's water started to get tainted by chemicals and turned into what it became. It wasn't news to them. They were watching this happen to them. And I think journalists have a responsibility to elevate those voices as part of our policy debates. That's question two. Question three, who else had to say yes to this? Or who else has a say in this or should have a say in this? So you think about bike share or scooters is the hot one today. So you'll see dockless scooters, e-scooters popping up in different cities. And in one sense, yes, we want to get more folks, more transportation options. We want to get more environmentally responsible transportation options. But when the scooters show up in a city unannounced overnight with no warning and no engagement from the city, from any community-based organization in that city, who else should have had to say yes? I mean, like, companies are doing this. Like, it just happened in Charleston a couple months ago. Scooters just showed up. And the Department of Transportation said, excuse me, did you were you going to ask us, engage us at all as a city, or were you just going to, like, drop these in all over the place and suddenly saddle us with the burden of having to clean up a bunch of thrown-away scooters that are, like, lining our streets and parks because, you know, there was no engagement here? Who else had to say yes? We'll often entail a zoning department or a planning department when we're talking about, let's say, solar panels, for instance. In Brownsville, Texas, a city right in the border, that city recently tweaked its zoning and its permitting process to allow and encourage more small business owners to put solar panels on the tops of their buildings. You know, that's a zoning thing that had to happen. And there's a very interesting story behind that because we're talking about, you know, a young kind of planner, urban planner in the planning department wants to encourage cleaner energy across the city. Had noticed that people were complaining that they wanted to build solar panels, but it takes too long to get through the planning department to get the permits and the permission to put the solar panels on the buildings. So that's another kind of way to navigate a city is who else has to say yes to this thing? You know, and whatever's coming through, whether it's scooters or solar panels or some kind of transportation thing, some kind of clean energy thing or some kind of water thing, who has to say yes to this to make it work? And the last question, I think I'll end on because I think this is the end of my 10 minutes. The last question is, who pays for this? Or how is it getting paid for? So, for instance, federal government dollars. So community development block grants are part of the Department of Housing and Urban Development's programs. You may have heard about them. You may know that community development block grants in real dollar terms peaked in 1979 and have gone down every year, pretty much every year since 1979. Nominally, they peaked in 1995 with around almost $5 billion in community development block grants. Today, they're about $2 billion. It goes down every year. It's the easiest thing for Congress to cut. 10% of community development block grants in any given year typically go to water and sewer improvements. No one knows that. No one knows that those are vital dollars for those projects because it's a very flexible program. Like when you say community development block grants, there's literally like 103 different uses that are eligible under the community development block grants. One of them is water and sewer improvements. And elevating that as part of, like, giving credit, again, where credit's due, like, no one defends community development block grants. It's why they go down every year. But it's a vital source of water and sewer improvement dollars. Federal dollars is one place. Another thing that's popping up is private financing in creative structures. Like there's things called environmental impact bonds where, let's say, a city issues a bond, investors buy the bond, and the repayment to the investors is based on, you know, how much stormwater did we reduce or how much stormwater retention did we increase as a result of the capital that these investors put up. And the more we retain as a city, the more properties we're able to make stormwater retention improvements, the more investors get paid back. You know, it's a very risky thing. It's kind of it can be problematic in terms of, okay, so why are we letting Wall Street investors make money off of this issue? But like the fact is, where else are we going to get the dollars in some case? So environmental impact bonds is one thing. DC has an innovative program, and I'm wondering where other cities might do this. DC does stormwater retention credits. similar to like carbon offset tax, carbon offset credits. So there's a market building now around DC, the same way that California has a market for carbon credits, where the Archdiocese in DC made a bunch of stormwater improvements to their cemeteries, a lot of cemeteries in DC, if you know the city. And they got investors to pay up front to make those stormwater retention improvements to the cemeteries in D.C., because we're talking about the Archdiocese, and even though it's a wealthy organization in terms of land, they don't have much cash. So they went to investors, they got the cash up front, they paid for the stormwater retention, and now the city gives them the stormwater retention credits. They sell them to developers who aren't meeting the needs of stormwater retention on their properties, and they pay back the investors with the credit dollars. So that's another example of like who pays for this thing, and I think that's my time. So the four questions are: who benefits? Who else had to say yes to this? Whose idea was this? And how do you pay for it?
That was great. Thank you. Very concise. Serena.
Hi there. My name is Serena Maria Daniels, and I'm the founder of Tostada Magazine. I'm also a freelance journalist based in Detroit. I came into journalism with kind of a really broad goal or mission to improve media representation of people of color, immigrant populations, Latinos, marginalized communities. I came about achieving that mission in a very roundabout way. I went through like the very typical channels of like working my way up as an entry level reporter at daily newspapers. I covered a lot of breaking news. So I'm originally from Southern California, so that meant in terms of environment, that was covering a lot of brush fires and many earthquakes and weather and that sort of thing. I moved to Michigan in 2011. Same thing, covering a lot of breaking news, that sort of thing. But in 2015, I had been a freelancer by then, and I was working with Reuters, and that's the first time that I covered anything to do with the Flint water crisis. It was very reactionary. I drive up to Flint weekly for a period of time, as did a lot of Detroit reporters, because there simply wasn't like the media infrastructure here to really tackle investigative kind of environmental journalism, which I'm sure a lot of you are more familiar with. I would say through freelancing, I was really able to kind of tackle those issues around equity and representation in the media. And you might be asking, like, well, what does this have to do with environmental journalism? I would say that especially a lot of the work that I've done with Next City has been around built environment, as in like what sort of access do residents have to parks or to healthy food or to clean water or, what is the state of the roads? What is the state of the sidewalks? Are you able to walk around safely in your neighborhood? And a lot of marginalized communities don't have access to a lot of those key points. And so what I look at with Next City is what are some of those inequities and what are people doing to try to address them? Next City is very solutions-based journalism, meaning that how do we describe it? I would say instead of saying gotcha or, like unearthing something that might take, years of investigative journalism, we look at issues that are known and, you know, and look at the actors who are trying to address it. And so, you know, some of the things that I've written about with Next City, well, a lot of it has to do with food and food access. Detroit has a lot of issues around that. We lack a lot of mainstream chain supermarkets. A lot of people have to leave the city to access, you know, to access like your Kroger or, you know, your large supermarket. But there are a lot of efforts to keep people in the city. There's a lot of urban gardening, and there's a lot of effort to, you know, create more equitable grocery options. So, like, there's an effort underway to create a co-op, a food co-op, and there would be urban gardens surrounding it. Residents would be able to kind of buy a stake in it, buy, you know, their own share in it, and then they would have more of a say of what goes into the store. You know, a lot of the current grocery options are like, well, what we call party stores, liquor stores. Mm. And so people are eating, you know, there's higher instances of, you know, diabetes and heart problems and obesity. And that, you know, and that's all related to, you know, what people have access to at some of these liquor stores, whether it's, you know, chips or alcohol or junk food or cigarettes. And so, but again, there are people who are working to address that by, like, I recently wrote about a woman who sells vegan tacos. And so, and her goal is to decolonize people's diets. And so what does that mean? That means, like, only preparing food that was accessed by, you know, local produce, you know, not turning to factory-made tortillas or, you know, reducing, like, artificial sweeteners, you know, maybe using honey or agave syrup or something along those lines. And, you know, food reporting can sometimes, like, feel frivolous or fluff, or it's just, like, for entertainment. But by covering, by looking at our built environment, looking at what are some of the problems around access to quality food, you can really, you know, take the vegan taco truck story and you know, find a solution to a serious problem within marginalized communities. Let me see. So yeah, that's the food end of it. Like I said, I am the founder of tostadamagazine.com. That's, again, looking at food, whether it's, you know, looking at some of these problems and how are people addressing them, but also just a celebration of people's cultures. I strongly believe that food is a means of preserving one's heritage, preserving one's culture. And so if you kind of whitewash it, then, or take it out of context, or remove the people who actually created that food from the equation, then you're erasing culture. So it's, would I say that's exactly environmental? I could make that argument just in the fact that, you know, so much of our understanding of the world has to do with what we eat. So, My focus is Detroit for now. I'm looking at the possibility of expanding or accepting contributions from people in other cities. But I think big picture, some of these stories are pretty universal. So it doesn't really matter if you're in Detroit or Flint or California or Chicago or what have you. A lot of the themes are pretty common. Let me see. When some of the things that I look at in terms of reporting is just looking at who am I interviewing. A lot of times, experts, people in power, CEOs tend to, fit a certain demographic. And so it's my goal as much as possible to interview women, interview people of color, interview people who otherwise don't get a voice in the media. And so that I think that really, again, it hits back to what that big picture goal is providing representation. And also looking at what their background is. So a lot of times if I'm covering immigration or crime or what have you, there tends to be an overrepresentation of people of color in those categories as either victims or criminals or a lot of times end up fitting those categories. And so just being really mindful of not falling into that trap, I think, makes a big difference. And so, if I need to interview an expert, a professor, or something along those lines, just take a little bit extra time to find the people who are not always quoted.
Usual suspects.
Uh-huh. Yeah, definitely.
Is that a good place to maybe move on to Rick? And then I'm sure more of these points will come up as we get conversation going. So, Rick.
Cool. Hi, everybody. I'm Rick Sadler. I'm an assistant professor in the Division of Public Health at Michigan State University, and I'm located here in Flint. So I wanted to share just a little bit about my work and how the media has, how I've seen the media cover the work that I've been involved in. So I'm a geographer. I'm literally the map guy, and so in a school of public health, that means that I wound up being pretty agnostic to the health outcome, but what I've always been interested in is the health of cities. So books like both like Deep Economy and Triumph of the City, kind of this whole idea of thinking about economy not just as higher yields, but also thinking of cities as the places where we can be most efficient in growing our economy, in being environmentally sustainable. So that's my undergrad was in environmental science, and then I wound up in geography/urban planning, focusing on urban inequality because of the fact that really strong cities have to be equitable and places where people of all kinds can cohabit, because if we all just live in suburbs, I guess I'll get to more of that. I'm getting ahead of myself. But so the type of work that I do is I'll often wind up with some kind of I'll look for geographic patterns in data and then say what's the relationship between this pattern and some other phenomenon, or linking research subjects to the geographic patterns that I find. So, for instance, examining whether people in neighborhoods with better access to healthy food have better blood glucose levels. And spoiler alert, we did find a modest relationship with that. So that's a paper that should be out soon. So diabetic patients are basically better able to manage their diabetes in neighborhoods with better food access, in the case of one sample of people in Flint. Or whether people in neighborhoods with low crime or less blight are more physically active or have better mental health because they're not afraid to go out into their neighborhoods for various different reasons. Or, obviously, if people who are exposed to more lead in their water systems have higher lead levels in their blood. I work with Dr. Mona, the Hurley pediatrician that blew up the water crisis. I'm also her map guy. And so I did the GIS analysis that helped her kind of prove the case that she already knew was the case, but it was kind of like the visual graphic that I guess was partly needed to help convey that information. And it connects to my philosophy on strong urban planning because of the fact that when I think about like what environmental issues are important to cities, it's the fact that for 70 years we didn't really build cities. We built suburbs and subdivisions and highways, and we weren't focused on building a civilization. We were building these little pods where we could all have our washing machines and refrigerators and stovetops and backyards and everything. But we know that sprawl is unsustainable, and Flint is a poster child for that because of the fact that particularly here in Michigan, we have what we call home rule local governance. And so the state, starting in the 40s and 50s, as townships started to grow, the townships had a little bit more political sway, and cities wanted to keep annexing into the townships because that's what cities have done forever. You build the wall around your city, and then everybody lives inside the wall because cities have efficiencies and safety and so forth. But so the state started supporting suburban development at the expense of urban development. And Flint being, you know, really not economically diversified and having these underlying racial issues related to discrimination in housing and employment, wound up, as we know, kind of being that poster child for the negative effects of urban decline. But still, I haven't heard anything from the state in 3-plus years of this water crisis going on, them communicating in any way that they could actually make changes to land use policy that would prevent cities from having infrastructure crises. Because when you grow a city to 200,000 people and thousands of automobile industrial jobs, you build infrastructure to accommodate it. And then when you lose half the population, obviously you can't afford that. And when you have a state system that specifically supports that abandonment and people moving out into suburbs and recreating that same infrastructure in suburbs in less efficient ways, like, we know what the solution to that is, but sorry. So that's a little bit of a digression. But so related to a couple of the ways that I would ideally like to see the media cover the research that I do a little bit more sensibly, there's kind of two things that I thought of. And one of them is this challenge of conveying structural issues to the general public. So, and by structural, I mean like the difference between individual behavioral determinants of health and social structural determinants of health. So, for example, like the idea that gets kind of reduced in the news is like, oh, food deserts are places where people need to be able to access healthy food, as opposed to writing from the perspective of like the whole food system is broken and doesn't give opportunity to people who live in places where there's not a high concentration of wealth or population. And also, for instance, and the local news actually did a really interesting story on Flint's decline and like trying to push that whole structural side of like, you know, it's not the fault of the people who live in Flint that Flint is having these challenges. It's partly, you know, this effect of everybody who left the city and the state policy. But I don't see a lot of that in the news just because, you know, it's easier to like focus on that individual story or I guess at worst do victim blaming. So that challenge of kind of conveying those structural issues. The other challenge is the kind of esoteric nature of methodological issues in mapping. So as a guy who makes maps, I don't just like go out into the woods with my surveying tools and like I'm not making those kinds of maps. I'm making maps of the patterns of data that we can collect from cities and from health departments and like throwing all that stuff together. And so we aren't always just asking the question of like, who has poor access to healthy food? We might be asking the question of how can we measure access to healthy food better so that we can be more sure that the question we're asking as researchers is refined well enough. So it'd be like taking blood pressure by, like holding somebody's wrist versus actually using like a blood pressure cuff. So we're trying to like be more precise with the way we measure them. But what winds up happening is like in the story, like the headline is like, poor Flint residents have poor access to healthy food. And it's like, well, we know that, but the kind of the goal of the research was to answer it better so that we could then go ask other questions, like what's the relationship between that access and health behaviors and health outcomes. And then also related to the water crisis, so there's a phenomenon called the modifiable aerial unit problem. And so it's of interest to me because I'm a geographer, but it's basically what was responsible for the state overlooking the effect of the water source change on Flint resident on kids' blood lead levels. And so when Mona started looking at her data, she saw this disparity between kids who lived in Flint and kids who didn't live in Flint. And so she had me geocode those kids and locate them either actually in the city or not. The state was only looking at zip codes, and zip codes in the city of Flint don't at all align to the city limits because we have townships that don't have post offices. And so it's all just kind of the post office designation means nothing with respect to like public health issues. But so, I mean, there's all kinds of these like methodological issues that cause research to wind up answering the wrong question or answering the question incorrectly because they aren't looking at the data in the right way. And I mean, I don't know, there's no real sexy way to write about that kind of stuff. But I mean, maybe there is. I
think you just did.
Yeah. Well, he wrote a piece for us at the Conversation about this whole issue of the zip codes and how they didn't match with, you know, the questions that they were trying to find.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess one just I would just suggest one takeaway is if you're talking to a scholar or an analyst who does, who you know does in-depth research like this, it is to try to really understand what they're doing. Which can take time. I mean, it takes time, and you have to sort of unpack it more and sometimes weed through stuff to really sort of feel like you're getting it. But, you know, it's worth it.
Yeah,
so
for sure. Yeah, and so I guess one concluding thought is that, you know, I see it because we have such an anti-urban bias in our society and have for so many years, like, oh, cities are these scary, dark places where crime happens. And it's like, no, cities are where innovation happens. It's where our whole economies are rooted. Like 80% of our population lives in and around cities. And so if we only, I mean, not that the media is doing this, but just societally overall, if we just think of cities as places that have those negative stories as opposed to like, cities are where most of us live, so sure, there's going to be negative stories, but it's also like the totality of our society. I think that, like, again, focusing on those good stories and doing so, like, from a lens of health equity. So, and I didn't mention, but I work with Deborah Verholden, who some of you might have been on a tour with. She's the director of the Flint Center for Health Equity Solutions, and I work on one part of that with her. And so our whole goal is to increase health equity in cities, particularly in Flint, but from the perspective that by doing so, we make them more attractive for the people who are already here. We make them more attractive for new development, but in the process of getting that new development, we do so in a way that we're not just displacing the people who are already here. And so we make a community actually for everybody.
Great. Thank you so much, all three of you. This was all just really interesting stuff and lots of food for thought, so I'm sure that people have questions. The policy for these meetings is that SEJ members with the blue badges get priority for asking questions, and I'm going to repeat the questions because we're recording the session so that people who couldn't be here now can download it later and listen to it. So does anyone have questions right off the bat? Great. Lisa. Yeah, and identify yourself, please,
yeah,
the way Lisa did. Yeah.
I have a question. It's actually for all of you, if you can find a way to answer it simply. I know that some of these stories that I want to tell, at least, especially around urban systems, obviously humans are the complex stories. And we're often asked to write, I'm often asked to write a story, and I want to write it in a complex way. And so how do you sort of work with and advise writers about how to tell these stories and, you know, how to structure them while retaining the complexity but making it readable. And how do you maybe talk about your work in a way that's, I know it's a very complex thing, but finding that thread.
Great. So the question was basically about how to really sort of probe and explore the complexity of some of these stories. And at the same time, keep the stories readable and compelling.
So, really great question. And one way that I've learned to do that over the past few years, so I started writing for Next City in 2015, and the way I've learned to do it is to follow one person's journey through that complex system.
it may be someone from the community. It may be someone who doesn't really get interviewed a lot. Like, it might be a loan officer at a credit union, or it might be a financial counselor who's helping clients, helping hundreds of clients kind of navigate payday lending versus other options. But yes, these are complex systems in cities. There are many layers, and there's zoning departments. There's policymakers at all three levels, federal, state, and local, who may be may be part of a story. But yeah, at the end of the day, there's someone on the ground somewhere who's navigating that complex system, and to walk with them through a story of like, okay, we're a credit union. We're based in Jackson, and before the Great Recession, we had 7 branches, and now we have 32. How did we do that? Well, here are the five or six like big steps along the way to make it happen. And you're not just reporting on a complex system. You're reporting on, well, first we did this, and then we did this, and here are some folks that helped us along the way. That's another way of thinking about complexity, is a story of people coming together around a problem, whether it's a new policy or a new program or some kind of new business model. Complexity is about, you know, different systems emerging, right? So what are we talking about when we say different systems emerging? We're talking about literally people with jobs and organizations that are coming together in new ways and forming new partnerships. That's kind of how we think about complexity at Next City when we think about how to help writers go through that. You've got to find that person, and sometimes it's the CEO of the credit union. Sometimes it's a branch manager. Sometimes it's a community organizer who's been looking at this issue for several years. Sometimes it's the city planner for that neighborhood who is watching the neighborhood grapple with gentrification or environmental displacement. You know, when you think about a city like Miami or New Orleans, coastal cities, where we're thinking about what's going to happen when the sea levels rise, and who's going to have to move first, and where are they going to move, and how are they going to get access to the capital to move. Those are all, people are grappling with that every day, and the idea is to get past the top level CEO, and it may be the person in the middle. Like, there's a CEO of a credit union, there's a mayor, there's a governor, there's a council member, there's someone on the ground who's benefiting or should be benefiting from this. There's also many people in between, and I guess that's where to find the person who's navigating the complex system to really tell the story of, like, well, you know, how did we ultimately get the capital for this housing project? How do we ultimately get the solar panels on the tops of these buildings? That's someone in between who's weaving it all together. That's generally how we approach it.
Other thoughts?
Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to echo, really, I think it's really important to find the real person. When I worked at the Detroit News, they had been under Gannett ownership for a while, and they had this rule about, like, real people as opposed to, like, you know, government officials or, you know, CEOs or, you know, the people in power. Like, find me X number of real people for the story. And so I always try to open with that. I just find it to be a useful tool. It's really easy to, and I'm actually kind of working through this myself right now. You know, when you're pitching a story idea, to want to just dump all the information and the big, what is the big theme I'm trying to tell? And it's impossible. You have to be able to distill it down. And I think finding that relatable person who's not necessarily in power, and, you know, kind of opening with them and closing with them as well, to kind of give it a full circle. So,
and I just throw in, from my work as a researcher, think about, like, the end of the logic chain. So if the work I'm doing as the researcher is this tiny little nugget way upstream, focus on, okay, but what's the effect of, what is it that we're trying to solve? Are we trying to solve cardiovascular disease among, you know, middle-aged so-and-so, whatever, people in some subpopulation? Just, I guess, focus on that. And I don't know if it works, but kind of like a take my word for it, these researchers say that this thing is connected to these things that ultimately lead to this. And then at least you have that appeal for, I mean, like, look, we want to reduce healthcare costs and improve quality of life and all that.
Great, thanks. Just on the, like, taking a person and following them through, I don't know if you guys would have heard this, but Michael Pollan, he's a Nature writer who's had big bestsellers. I heard him once at a conference talking about this idea of finding, you know, someone to guide you through a complex thing. And for his book, Omnivore's Dilemma, which is all about the complexity of the food system and all the craziness, he was trying to explain, he was going to write a New York Times Magazine article about it that eventually became a chunk of the book. And he said, I was just unloading all this data on my editor and going, oh, it's the system and it does this and it does that. And my editor just listened and finally said, why don't you buy a cow and follow it all the way from, you know, birth to the slaughterhouse? And he said, and I just went,
oh,
so I was like, sometimes it doesn't have to be a human. But he said he was literally just like drowning in all this stuff, and his editor just like cut right through it, and he ended up buying the cow and writing the article about the cow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Adam.
I'm Adam Lynn, and I teach a young journalist at Hunter College. I'm hoping to start a course in urban environmental issues, and I have a two-pronged question. One is, if you have suggestions about the kinds of urban issues that you think starting journalists might be able to grasp and cover and return something that would, you know, make them feel proud of and not overwhelmed by. But the other question is this: we talked. You mentioned solutions journalism. You mentioned working with community-based organizations, both of which I've done as a journalist. But for a young journalist who's just learning the traditional values, where are the kind of fault lines between becoming, embracing a community-based organization and its solutions too closely, which I think young journalists may be more prone to?
I have a quick thought on that.
Great. Actually, let me just repeat the recording. Sorry, they've beat us over the head about this. So the first part, let me make sure I get this right, is what are some good urban environmental issues for young journalists to tackle that they can handle and presumably work with? And then about some of the pitfalls of solutions journalism, and in particularly getting too close to a person or a group or something, and maybe overspinning their story. Got it.
Just a quick thought on the first half of your question that particularly as it pertains my work, again, because some of it can be kind of complex, esoteric, strange, the question of environmental injustice and, like, for instance, the links between one's environment and their race or economics and their health, like pollution, polluting factories, the point source pollution are pretty accessible ways of digging into something like that, because you can point and say, look, there's that factory, you can see the smoke blowing eastward, and so this neighborhood has this bigger issue. And then they can start to understand that relationship between the built environment and health.
I think details are what's lacking in a lot of reporting with young journalists. Because, you know, they get overwhelmed, or because, you know, they feel like maybe they have to, you know, fill in a specific formula of, like, how to write a story. And, you know, if a press release is sent to them, then, you know, sure, there's a tendency to kind of, like, just rewrite it in their own words. But one easy way to tackle that would be to, like, do the activity that you're trying to report on. So, like, if you're reporting on public transportation, get on the bus and document, like, how long it takes for you to get from home to your office. Just things like that to place the reporter in their source's shoes, so they don't have to necessarily take the word of that person. One activity I did on food deserts is I made a grocery list and tried to purchase, you know, all the items on the grocery list in a city that lacked a real supermarket. And so, you know, it took me like
hours and going to all these different little, you know, convenience stores and stuff like that to find, like, you know, a gallon of milk, to find an orange, to find a head of lettuce, like stuff like that. And so, yeah, I think that's like an easy, approachable way to kind of tackle that. So,
yeah, I'll reiterate on the food point. I think that's a very approachable one, and one you can do a little bit of research, just as a younger journalist or student journalist, going around to different neighborhoods and like thinking, okay, so I'm here at this address talking to this organization or this resident or whoever it is, and you know I can look around and think it's going to take 15 minutes to walk there or 30 minutes to walk there or an hour to walk there or maybe there's nowhere to walk within some reasonable amount of time to get food, to get healthy food. So that's an issue I would say is very approachable. Also the point of single point of pollution, like yes, there's just some terrific stories around Baltimore, for example, where it has been students of high schools near an incinerator who actually organized to like well, they were going to be near the incinerator, but they stopped it from getting built. And that's often student organizing. So maybe that's another way to guide younger journalists, is sometimes it actually is youth who are organizing around certain issues. So that's an easy way to kind of get them connected and like excited about a story. And then to your second point about solutions journalism and how to not get too close, I would emphasize the context part of solutions journalism. I mean, we're still talking about problems, right? We're still talking about access to food. We're still talking about cleaner air, cleaner water, more sustainable transportation, more sustainable cities. Talk about it in the context, but in solutions journalism, you want to make sure you give a sense of the whole problem. And this one group is working on this small piece of it. And here's why it's important, and here's some interesting people around this piece of the solution. But it's a bigger problem out there that this one thing isn't going to solve. And emphasizing that part of the story and making sure that you have access to data to show how big the problem is, and make sure that this way you can tell the story of like it's not just one little group is doing this amazing thing in this neighborhood. It's like, well, there's a bigger problem here, and here's how one community is responding to it. Right.
Great, thank you. Other questions? Yeah.
My name's Mo. I'm a grad student at the University of Colorado. Kind of off of that, I'm currently struggling on going too broad, and I do that all the time. So any advice on how to tether yourself and not go too broad?
Question is how to avoid going too broad and drowning in your research.
Yeah. And I guess
and then finding the story in it, right? Yeah.
And I guess a little bit of context. I'm working a lot on gentrification and the changes happening in Denver and a couple neighborhoods, and I'm very data focused. Mm-hmm. But
Yeah. Right.
Did you want to?
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, that was a good point, was that, because that's a great example, is gentrification, which is one of these complex processes, and there is a lot of data, but that is the downside of data journalism, is that you can drown in your data. So
yeah, the question of how do you go balance against going too broad, I'm probably the worst editor to ask this question, because I'd rather just say, you know what, just give me everything. I'll sort it out. I'd rather have all of it. So I don't know. Trust your editor. Is that the answer? Work with editors that will do that for you, that are interested in doing that for you. Find them. I'm here. I don't know how else to do it, because that's part of what I think we have to do. Like I learned how to do it before, how to give everything I think was important for this story, and let my editors decide. Okay, we'll go out to like maybe not the 10 degrees you went out to, we'll go out to like 7. And that's where we'll stop it, partly because of word count. So that's fine. And figuring out also, trusting your editors to figure out the shorthand to like explain, we're only going out to 7 degrees, not the 15 degrees. But there's more to this story. Find editors you can trust to do that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's great. He's my editor, one of them. Mm-hmm. I struggle with this a lot, and actually very recently I got some great advice. Get some sticky notes and then write, this story is about, and then write down what it's about. And try to be as succinct as possible. Like,
you mean like what, on one sticky note what it's about, or can you do like a chain?
that's the thing.
Yeah.
You know, write the headline, whatever whatever the hook is, and then stick it somewhere visible to remind yourself. But do that constantly. So when you feel stuck, write it out again on another sticky note. And then you can visually see like how the story is evolving, how it's changing. Because you're going to interview other people, you're going to get some other data, and it's going to feel overwhelming. But if you have those visual reminders, it will keep you on track. So I've the sticky note, that's new. I'm gonna test that myself. But just keeping that mental note, this story is about, that helps to keep you from, you know, going all these different directions. So.
And I can commiserate as a recently former grad student, because you have to pick one topic, and going into an urban geography program, I wanted to fix everything about cities that was wrong. But I learned in my writing to give myself a little bit of room to say, like, okay, there's a billion issues, and like just kind of mention a couple of them and then say, and today I'm going to talk about this one particular sub-issue of this topic.
I would just second one thing Oscar said about editors, which is that when I was freelancing, which I did for a decade before I worked at The Conversation, it often would bug me when an editor, I would send in my draft and an editor would say, okay, this is good start, and now can you like explain me more about this, send me more about this, and I would end up sending a whole bunch more, and then they're about like 60% of it maybe, you know, sort of somewhere in the center of all this stuff I'd produced would end up as the story, and at first I would be like, why did you ask for all that other stuff? And at some point I realized they're sort of helping me figure out like where the story is in all of that. Sorry, I jumped in.
Yeah. I guess another thing to think about too is if you do think as a freelancer or as I don't know if how many staff writers there might be doing, might be covering these kinds of issues, but I also learned once I started doing this for a couple of years that if there was a piece I felt was compelling and I wanted to write about it, it didn't necessarily have to be for this story. Just think about the next pitch. And it's not it may or may not be a direct follow-up, but like the idea of, to borrow Serena's tool, to like, okay, this story is about this one thing. And maybe there's two or three other ideas in here that I can do later. I'll do that later. And I can be okay with that.
Yeah, that's a great idea. So we can go till 12:15, and then everybody has to power down for the lunch. So if you've got your questions, get them up here. Others? Yeah.
I feel like I'm someone who's sort of shifting to covering environmental stuff for the first time after having covered like hard news, breaking news for 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I find it challenging sometimes to find the hook or to know sort of define the scope of a story with an environmental issue, because a lot of them sort of go on for a long time, and it's, you're trying to bite off a piece in time of this story. And I'm curious what advice you might have for sort of, you know, finding hooks or for drilling down on an issue that may sort of span 5, 10, 20 years.
Right. Right. Yeah, I don't know where the line comes from that environmental stories don't break, they ooze.
Yes.
Right, but so it's about, right. So if you've got a very long, slow developing story like that, where to find the hook and the now piece of the story?
Yeah, define yourself.
Right, how to define it and report on it now.
Yeah.
Right.
I might point to precedent. So if there's anything even remotely resembling it in the past, like saying, okay, we're only a couple of years into this, but look what happened 20 years ago, or what could happen. And I don't know if that would wind up being too sensational, but, I mean, you could open up, you know, look, here's three or four outcomes that could wind up happening if we don't act more quickly on this now.
A lot of our news pegs tend to revolve around funding announcements or deadlines. you know, this city's issuing a bond. They're going to vote on it this fall. So here's what they plan to do with it, and you know that can be a news peg for an environmental story. Sometimes it's within a specific project. So like solar panels. You know, this new solar farm is coming into operation, and again, it's part of the for us at with a media organization that has a solutions orientation. The longer slower oozing picture of like cleaner energy is there, but like okay, so here's a new solar farm that's coming online in La Crosse, Wisconsin. For some strange reason, they have a solar farm there. So, boom, that's a story. Another deadline can be data if there's a new study coming out. I wouldn't make the study necessarily the focus of the story. I wouldn't. I mean, we always want to write about. We want to go deeper into or go broader into like, okay, so who's working on this issue in somewhere, and they might have some cool program to like drive awareness of. Oh, like some cities have tax incentives for rain buckets or rain barrels for homeowners' buildings to like have stormwater retention on their properties. Like those are just around. So here's a study. Maybe someone produces a study that says this thing is like really important, and here's a city that has been able to increase its stormwater retention through this tax incentive program. I'm like, okay, that I'll use that as a news peg, but I'm going to focus the story on whose idea was it to pass the city level policy to make the rain barrels happen. There's somebody that probably there that did it 5-10 years ago that got the policy passed and. They deserve the credit for helping to get it passed. So that's, you know, again, like data can be a news peg, but like make sure you go past it, because if you're doing a solution story, go past it to like where is the solution for this thing that this data is now validating. Who deserves credit for that?
I would say for this beat, any beat really, think of your whole body of work and what is it you want to accomplish. If someone asks, like, you know, what's your beat or what's your specialty? So if you think of it like that, how do you become that expert? Well, it takes like hundreds of mini dispatches. And so if you're in Cape Cod, is that correct? Okay, so you just make little, you know, daily stories around that expertise that you want to follow and continue with that. So like my specialty is food. A lot of it is Latin food, a lot of it is Mexican food. So what does it take to become that expert? What will it take for you to own every aspect of that beat? You have to know all about marinated meats or, you know, taco fillings or, you know, types of tortillas and you're just building your encyclopedia, if you will, or your Wikipedia of every detail. So I think especially if we come from like the breaking news or daily kind of grind into going into like a specialty, it can be overwhelming. And when we're in that arena of being like a GA reporter, there's all this pressure like, well, when am I going to break out into doing something more specialized? And so you have to find ways to sneak those stories that you really care about into your weekly mix. Well, how do you do that if you don't have time? You just write, just keep it short. Don't worry about if it's the, you know, all-encompassing anthology on whatever the topic might be. You can get to that with these mini stories. So.
Yeah, there's one. I'll lift up one example that I actually worked on with Serena. She mentioned the decolonized food truck kind of story, and there were pieces in that story that Serena referenced about, you know, what does it mean to have a decolonized diet, and you know there were some cookbooks that like recipe books that came out about it a few years ago, and she referenced a lot because like she knows the space. And but what was the newspaper of the story? Was that food truck owner just got some funding to get their brick and mortar location up and running, mm-hmm. or started? Like they got a grant to get it moving. So like that was a news peg. So that gives Serena the opportunity as a reporter who's created a food beat for herself to like, all right, here's a news peg. Now I'm going to dive into like what the heck is a decolonized diet and why is it important? Mm-hmm. But I have this nice thing to say as part of like, oh, there's this new this food truck owner got a thing, which also for Next City, like we don't really care if one food truck owner goes and gets a brick and mortar. That happens fairly frequently, but like for this particular one, it was like this one has a strange thing that everyone needs to know more about. And sort of how we were able to get at the food issue, which is also like a slow burning issue, but have a news peg, and I think I'm trying to answer your question. But anyway.
Yeah, that's great. One or two more, maybe. Any questions? Yeah.
Hey, hello, my name is Valentina, and I'm from Chile. I'm a journalism student there. I was just wondering, I'm curious to know, who do you interview while doing environmental stories? Do you give, like, more priority to the people that are damaged or that have something to do with whatever you want to talk about, or you go more for authorities or owners of some place? Because, for example, the example you gave about the time you take in completing buying the grocery list, did you interview someone, or did you just talk about, like, it takes this time for someone who lives here where no supermarkets are available?
Okay. So, sorry, let me just get that on here. So the question was about choosing who to interview and whether you go to people who are affected by things or who are making decisions and running things and sort of how to, you know, locate who the story should be about. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I always think back to one of my mentors. He said, you know, if you go to like, I don't know, the scene of a crime at a house, and you ask, like, you know, the editor asks, well, what color was the house? Oh, it was white. Well, how do you know? Did you go around all the corners of the house to see, like, the color of the house from all the walls? So, like, you can look at it from one angle and it's white, but if you turn, you know, you go in the backyard, it might be blue or it might be a different color. And so that example I gave in terms of, like, you know, going to the different markets, that's one way to kind of verify, like, just how difficult it is to get that grocery list. So, you know, a resident might be able to say, you know, he might say, oh, you know, it takes me, you know, I have to take a bus, you know, for an hour to get to, you know, the kind of grocery store where I'm going to find all these items. I could take his word for it, or I could try it out myself as well. So he gives that voice, he gives that, like, personal anecdote, and then I verified it that way. So I think that's a good approach.
I would go back to the four questions and think about each of those voices as part of the story. So, and who benefits? Whose idea was this? Who else had to say yes, and who pays for it? Those can be four different people, four different voices, and depending on the publication too, I would say you may want to start with one or the other. You may only have time for one or two of the four, really. For something like gentrification or housing, you know, there's definitely some strong viewpoints at the ground level from residents in these neighborhoods. Those are voices you can draw from. There's voices of community organizers who are trying to work around and support different policies around this issue. There's council members, there's developers, and there's bankers and other folks who are funding these things. Those are, depending on the specific headline, the specific story, those are, you know, I bring up the four questions because it's how I sort of organize the voices. And then for this specific story, for this pitch, for Next City, we almost always start with whose idea was this? because we were a solutions-oriented publication. That's where we want to start. But if it's something, if it's a local paper or a New York Times, maybe, to think of a whole other level, you may want to start with the residents on the ground and to be able to say, this new thing is going to affect this person's life in this way, and here's why it's important at like the very ground level. You may want to start there for some pitches, for some publications. And as much as I'm curious about that, we don't always get that at a Next City story, because we definitely want to start with who's working on this issue. When we start there, we need that as part of any story. But to the extent that we can get down to the ground, to the extent that we can get out to the banks and whoever is financing this thing, we try to push from there. And like, so we start there and move out. Other publications might start with on the ground and then go from there. Yeah, I guess that's how I would prioritize voices.
We have to stop there because we have to get everybody here through the buffet line downstairs for lunch and get the panel up there and started. So please join me in thanking everyone here. This has been a great session. Find them afterward. Follow up. Pitch Next City.
Yes, please do.
Yeah.